You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
the following states have thus been elected members of the Security Council for the two-year term beginning 1st January 2005. Angola, Malaysia, New Zealand, Spain, and the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela.
Very much not on that list, however, Turkey, which had already hosted a victory party. We'll discuss that and the day's other top stories with our guests John Everard and Sebastian Borger. Also on the agenda, we'll reflect on Putin's visit to Italy and the reappearance of Kim Jong-un. We'll also catch up with our correspondent in Bogota and review the latest films with regular critic Tim Roby. All that and more besides coming up right now on Midori House on Monocle 24. An action-packed hour ahead, as ever, ahead of which Bill Bingham has the world news.
On news, Nigerian officials say they've reached a ceasefire deal with Boko Haram militants that includes the release of more than 200 kidnapped schoolgirls. The Nigerian state broadcaster NTA says the deal between the government and the Islamist terror group was confirmed by senior counter-terrorism officials on Friday. The agreement includes an end to hostilities, along with the release of 219 girls held captive since April. UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has urged countries around the world to do more to help in the fight against Ebola. He's described a lack of donations to an emergency aid fund as a very serious problem, adding it was time more countries increased their assistance. The Trust Fund, seeking flexible funding to provide the most urgent help to fight Ebola in West Africa, says it's a long way short of its $1 billion target a month after it was set up. US Secretary of State John Kerry says there's an urgent need for countries to work together.
Meeting this crisis is going to require that we draw on each other's collective experience and our collective capacities. No one country, no individual group of nations is going to resolve this problem by themselves. This is going to take a collective global response, all hands on deck. That's the only way to get it done.
New clashes have broken out between Hong Kong police and pro-democracy protesters. Officers have been using pepper spray and batons against the crowd. The scuffles erupted as demonstrators try to reclaim a protest site in Mong Kok, cleared by police early on Friday. A similar operation earlier this week sparked outrage after a video emerged of police beating a protester. Talks between European leaders and the heads of state from Russia and Ukraine continue in Italy, in a bid to resolve the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Vladimir Putin and President Petro Poroshenko have met German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande in Milan for a second time, after little progress in the first set of talks. Earlier, the four met Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi and British Prime Minister David Cameron for talks. Despite the lack of progress, Mr. Renzi says he's optimistic the disputes can be resolved.
Obviously, there are a lot of differences. This is normal. This is the reason for which we are in this situation. But I would underline the real desire to find solution, and for this reason I think we can be positive.
A Philippines-based militant group has released two German hostages captured in April. Local officials say the hostages were seized from a yacht between Malaysia and the Philippines. Abu Sayyaf had vowed to kill one hostage and demanded a ransom. The group claimed on Friday the $5.6 million ransom had been paid in full. The Muslim separatist group also called for an end to German support for the US-led coalition against Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. Search teams in Nepal have used shovels and ice axes to dig through thick snow and rescue about 40 hikers trapped for days on a Himalayan pass. Blizzards and avalanches killed at least 29 people around 2 days ago in one of the world's worst mountain disasters. The Trekking Agencies Association of Nepal says 37 people were brought down from the 18,000 feet high Turong La Pass. Austrians, French, Germans, Indians and Nepalis are among the nationalities represented. Police say 48 people have been rescued from different locations in the popular trekking region around Annapurna, the world's 10th highest peak, where some had sought shelter in a temple. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, which will be 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news, I have here in the studio John Everard, former UK ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Sebastian Borger, correspondent for Berliner Zeitung and Der Standard, among others. Welcome both to the programme. We will start with Turkey, which has already been having a rickety few weeks on the PR front. The spectacle of one soldier sleeping in the shadows of their tanks within view of a massacre of civilians being an unfortunate visual. In an apparent vote of no confidence by Turkey's fellow nations, Turkey has failed to win one of five non-permanent UN Security Council seats up for grabs, and which it very much fancied. John, I'll ask you first, is this a straightforward verdict on Turkey's recent behaviour?
It's partly a verdict on Turkey's recent behaviour. It's partly resentment against long-standing Turkish positions over Syria and, well, a range of other Middle Eastern questions. Partly, too, I think it was effective campaigning by Turkey's opponents. The Spanish tried very hard to get the seat, and in the end, their efforts paid off.
Sebastian, what have you made of this? Has Turkey really upset people to the extent that they would not include them on the Security Council?
I don't believe so. I think, as John says, you know, the others were campaigning very hard, and they got the better of Turkey. There were three seats for Western countries on the cards. New Zealand got it easily, and then there was it was Spain or Turkey. This time it was Spain. I wouldn't read too much into it.
On that subject of New Zealand, of all places, getting the nod, and the last two Western reps are the outgoing after a two-year term are Australia and Luxembourg. John, you have some experience of the UN and of diplomatic ease in general. Does New Zealand's sort of accession confirm that being perceived as basically harmless and entirely inoffensive really does help you here?
Absolutely. This is a long-standing UN truism, that in these elections, you suffer much more from countries voting against you than you benefit from countries voting for you, see what I mean? If you simply keep your nose clean in UN terms, don't do anything to upset anybody, your chances of being elected are very heavily increased.
Can I just say, as a peaceful Bavarian, there's nothing wrong with being inoffensive and harmless. And maybe there are very good New Zealand diplomats who can chivvy the UN along.
I dare say that's the case, but it is hard to miss that New Zealand, a country which has literally never done anything to upset anybody, as far as I can understand, does seem to be the one everybody can agree on. Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlut Cavusoglu, which I almost certainly just made a terrible shambles of trying to pronounce there, sort of harumphed afterwards, "We could not abandon our principles for the sake of getting more votes."
Yes, lovely. Yes.
a brand new concept in the United Nations, I have to say.
What do we think he meant by that, other than that I'm an incredibly sore loser, but I'm trying not to sound it?
Nothing. Just I'm going to be so loser, I'm trying not to sound it. But there were glorious moments of the Turkish campaign. If you read the Turkish position paper on why everyone should elect Turkey, it talks about Turkey's unwavering commitment to the principles of the United Nations. I couldn't help wondering how you say that in Kurdish.
It has not been, as I was saying in the introduction to this, and we'll just discuss this before we move on to other things. How damaged do we... I'll ask each of you in turn, Sebastian, you first. In international terms, obviously Turkey has always fancied cemented itself massively as a significant regional player in both the Europe and the Middle East, and not without reason. It's a huge and important country. Yes. Mm. How damaged is it by what it's done, or rather not done, in the last few weeks?
I'm baffled by Turkey's position, and that goes beyond the Syria conflict. I mean, they seem to be abandoning their long-standing alliances, upsetting all sorts of people which they have no reason to upset. In Syria, to be fair to them, of course, they have a very long land border with Syria.
They certainly do.
They are in a much more difficult position than us here pontificating on what to do. And, I see a lot of places around the world who aren't doing very much at all on Syria, including my own country.
Because it's just struck me that a potentially somewhat charitable interpretation of Turkey's behaviour, and it's not, you see individual people do this as well as countries, is faced with an entire array of options, all of which look terrible, mm-hmm. They've decided to choose none of them.
Well, yes, that's broadly what is happening. The problem is that in choosing none of them, or for that matter, choosing any of them, you're going to start upsetting people. You know, Turkey was fighting a very sort of difficult hand from the word go. Could I, just before we leave this subject, point out that in a few weeks, we'll have all forgotten about Turkey not getting on the Security Council. The real humdinger isn't Turkey not getting on, it's Venezuela.
I was going to ask that, which does rather contradict our earlier rule about sort of militantly inoffensive countries getting ahead at the UN. How has this happened, and what is the United States likely to make of it?
The United States will sulk, but it isn't going to do anything to upset apple cart, I don't think. How has it happened? The way that the United Nations works is that the regional groupings are supposed to put forward candidates. Now, traditionally, you get agreed slates, so that there was just one Latin American, one African, and so on this time round. You only get votes, such as the one we talked about in the case of Turkey, where the groupings fail to agree a slate. And in the Latin American case, quite simply, the Latin Americans all agreed amongst themselves that Buggins' turn this time is Venezuela. I think a lot of Latin American governments would have gritted their teeth while they did this, but those are the Latin American rules and they play by them.
Okay, well, we will leave the UN there for the moment, and we will proceed seamlessly, however, on the subject of large and unpredictable countries run by paranoid authoritarians. President Vladimir Putin of Russia has been visiting Italy.
I thought you were talking about Germany there for a minute.
Where he met with EU leaders and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, and also paid a late-night social call on his old friend Silvio Berlusconi, a prospect doubtless boggling the imaginations of the world's satirical panel show scriptwriters, even as we speak. We will come back to that assignation shortly. But Sebastian, I'll ask you first. According to David Cameron, the UK's Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin said this morning that he doesn't want a frozen conflict or a divided Ukraine. And do we believe that?
We don't. No, but before he met Berlusconi, he met Angela Merkel last night, didn't he? Or was it after? I can't remember. But anyway, I mean, this group show this morning with Renzi and Cameron and all these people was a complete sideshow. Of course, the only people in town are the Americans and Angela Merkel, as far as I can see.
Do you think that's fair, John? Do you think most of the EU, most of the other EU leaders are the proverbial meat in the room at this one?
No, because the EU as a whole, as a collective, is imposing sanctions. So the views of people like Cameron and Renzi do actually matter in that context. And it's quite clear from Putin's noises off that the sanctions are biting and they've upset him a great deal. I think that Putin is now in quite a difficult position. He said he doesn't want a frozen conflict. We could believe that or not, as we like. What he hasn't said is what he does want. It's not clear what kind of outcome Russia is looking for from this. It's not even clear that the Russians themselves have made up their minds. Putin has a reputation for being a master tactician. You know, he'll leap from one place to another in the short term, but not a great strategist. And it may well be that at the moment, he and his government are still feeling their way.
He needs a way out. I think that's the feeling one gets.
Yes. I was going to ask, and I'll ask you, Sebastian. I mean, most people have thought that what Putin has been trying to accomplish in Ukraine was to keep Ukraine out of the EU and or demonstrate the EU's weakness. And on both of those counts, it's mission accomplished for Putin, isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yes, that's true. But again, I think John is entirely right. Where is the strategy? I mean, that's fine as far as it goes. goes, and it's also fine as far as Crimea goes. But beyond that, where is he going? He can't, you know. People talk, particularly in Germany, talk about the gas boycott now. We will all freeze. But well, not the Brits, but the Germans and the Italians will freeze by February. And I think, well, the guy will have to sell his stuff somewhere. So, you know, it doesn't work that way.
I'm so glad you made the point first, Sebastian. That's exactly right. He doesn't have so many customers, so many alternatives. He can afford to turn the taps off. You know, this is bluster. Mm. I don't think it's going to happen.
And he barely still has an economy. The ruble down 20% against the dollar this year, including 6.5% in the last month.
The economy is in nosedive, and Putin is starting to feel the heat. Not that Putin has a bleeding heart concern for the fate of ordinary Russians, but the oligarchs, on whose support he definitely relies, are starting to come up to him and say, "Big Vlad, we've had enough of this."
John, I do occasionally ask you to translate diplomatic ease for me and the benefit of our listeners. I wanted to run a couple of phrases by you. The British and Italian sources at the talks this morning described them as frank. A Kremlin spokesperson called them difficult, full of misunderstandings and disagreements, but they are nevertheless ongoing. That sounds like, you know, things might have got broken.
I suspect there are a few red faces. I suspect that people did stand up, thump tables, scream, shout, and that the staff will have removed all sharp objects from the room. Yeah, that's what frank means. The Russian phrase is Russian diplomatese for frank.
the Russians have just translated it for us, you think?
That's right.
We do need to talk. Well, actually, we don't need to talk about. I just very much want to talk about what Putin was doing the night before. The meeting with the EU leaders started this morning at 8 a.m. Putin was seen leaving Berlusconi's at past 3 o'clock. Sebastian, is he taking this seriously? You'd want a good night's sleep before a meeting like that, wouldn't you?
Maybe he got a good night's sleep. Margaret Thatcher got famously on with, 2.5 hours?
Well, so she liked to say, 2.5, 3 hours.
She got a few injections along the way.
Yeah, I was never reassured by that, to be honest. I would vastly prefer people with access to launch codes to have had a decent night's kip.
Well, she didn't invade a neighbouring country.
No, that is true. That is certainly true. John, Putin and Berlusconi, can we even begin to imagine what they would talk about?
Isn't it wonderful speculation? How big is your illicit fortune?
On that note, we will take a short break. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, as well as John Everard and Sebastian Borger. When we return, we will discuss the reappearance of Kim Jong-un, and we will mark 60 years of the transistor radio.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska's state ferry system afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
'24/7, 28 programs, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches, and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists, and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are John Everard and Sebastian Borger. Now this week, Rodong Sinmun, the North Korean Workers' Daily, has published two expansive accounts of Kim Jong-un beaming at building projects. This is only newsworthy because it followed 40 days of uncharacteristic silence on the subject of the Supreme Leader's activities, a blank canvas onto which was projected a rich pageant of conspiracy conjecture and invention up to and including a scenario I've just now made up, in which he became trapped in a harpsichord while trying to retrieve a cupcake. John, I'll ask you first, the UK's former man in Pyongyang, are you surprised by his re-emergence? Did you think he was gone for good?
I was starting to think that something deeply political had happened. And yes, I was slightly surprised to see him come back. But there we are, he is back. Various takeaways from this. Firstly, the country functioned normally, efficiently, well, as efficiently as ever.
Normally is a relative term in this context as well.
That is also so. But it functioned in his absence. I mean, he wrote a couple of letters during the 6 weeks he was away, but he can't have been discharging all his normal duties, which suggests that there's more than just Kim to this regime. There are people able to make decisions even when he's not around.
You knew that, didn't you?
Well, yes, but I think it's now been proven. The other point is that it encouraged a lot of North Korea watchers to work out what a silent coup against Kim might look like. We think we've ruled out his sister taking over, which is a running favourite at one point, the military taking over, which would have been messy. And the feeling is that if Kim ever went, it would be the party that simply shunted into one side and took over. And you know, the six-week absence was quite an interesting demonstration of that.
Now, Sebastian, what did you make of the coverage of it worldwide? Because it was one of those things where there was clearly a huge story and yet almost nobody really knew what it was.
And anybody wanted to know was whether it was an Emmental allergy or a cheddar allergy. Yes.
This was one of the theories doing the rounds, that it was an over-fondness for cheese.
Too much cheese, yes.
Had got to him.
No, I think it's a... Wasn't it a slightly frightened silence? Because after all, he or somebody there has their fingers on a very unpleasant trigger.
It was very, very strange. John, in these pictures that have now reappeared of him, which we assume we're having to take the Workers' Daily's word for it, were actually taken recently, he is attended by his usual entourage of enthusiastic note-takers. Are there any significant faces among
yes,
them?
Yes, there are a few. Firstly, the pictures are genuine. They've been worked over very carefully by photo experts. There's no doubt that they are current and of Kim with a cane. Significant people, Hwang Pyong-so is there, the man who on 4th of October arrived almost unannounced in Incheon at the end of the Asian Games in Kim Jong-un's private jet, seen looking very deferential to Kim and taking notes. Other interesting point about the photographs is a building site, not just any building site. This is the accommodation for scientists, says Rodong Sinmun. What it means is these are Kim's favourite missile scientists. Kim Jong-un, on his very first appearance after his absence, is signalling to the world that there's outreach going on, lots of North Koreans talking about talking right now, but there's a hard edge still to North Korea's diplomacy.
Sebastian, John was saying that during the Marshall's long absence, he was starting to think he was done for or gone for good or perhaps not coming back. Are you surprised to see him back?
No, I wasn't surprised to see him back. I mean, there were no indications, as far as I'm certainly no expert on North Korea, but there were no signs which indicated that there was a significant coup had gone on. No, I mean, it's just, I think that's the interesting thing now, that we know the country runs even without the leader, for at least for a while.
Does that surprise you? Did you get the impression when you were working there, John, that it actually was like a proper dictatorship in which some sort of thunderbolt thrower behind a desk actually was running everything? Or was your impression that the Kims were kind of a figurehead?
I think, no, when Kim Jong-il was around, it was a real one-man dictatorship. Kim Jong-il was a complete workaholic, used to work into the small hours, wading through papers, used to micromanage everything. Nobody sneezed in North Korea without Kim Jong-il either approving it or at least knowing about it. Kim Jong-un has a soul shall we say, more relaxed style. And it's the defectors have been telling us for a while that although he does these on-the-spot visits, he's the kind of public face of the regime, a lot of the day-to-day running is actually done by other people, people at senior levels in the party. So, no, it didn't surprise me to see that the country ran as normally as ever without Kim Jong-un.
Well, all that cheese isn't going to eat itself, I suppose. Finally, it is 60 years ago tomorrow that the first transistor radio went on sale. It was the Regency TR-1. It was made by a small electronics company in Indianapolis. It weighed 11 ounces, was available in a choice of black, ivory, red and grey, and cost $49.95, which is about $433 in today's money, or more or less the price of an iPod, coincidentally enough. Sebastian, is this a significant anniversary, do you think? Is it possible to date this as the beginning of mobile communications as we now know them?
How much is 11 ounces?
11 kilo? Ounces? I don't know, actually.
Anyway, sorry.
How heavy
is that?
I'm
being mischievous.
I grew up in a metric society as
I
well.
I know.
It's about that heavy.
John's gesturing with a jug of water there. It's about as heavy as a half full jug of water, apparently.
It's a marvelously quirky anniversary. I really like that. I must say I'm very interested in cultural history. I'd never heard of the invention of the transistor radio as a significant
It was news to me as well. It was in fact pointed out by John. But it is. I was interested to ask, especially people who'd grown up in Cold War Europe, about this, about the importance of the transistor radio as a political tool, because of course people could listen to broadcasts illicitly from the West in the East. Did it make a huge difference in that respect?
But lots of people were listening to broadcasts from the West in the East on stationary radios. I don't quite. You know, obviously. It's much easier to be able to carry it around and in that way it is significant. But what Western stations did to promote freedom in Eastern Europe was absolutely great, but not dependent on transistor radios.
It caused a youth revolution. I mean, I think this is the important point, that until the transistor radio arrived, you would have one radio in the house. It was big, it was bulky, and you always had to wait for it to warm up. I remember the little ritual as you turned it on and watched the vowels slowly glow. With transistors...
You don't remember that. Come on.
I'm too young for that. You say all the right things, Sebastian, but yes, I do remember that, I'm afraid. Whereas with transistors, yeah, I managed to sort of secure under my bed and listen to it, you know, to pirate radio stations at night. You could never have done that with a valve radio.
Well, this has been said, that this was the crucial role that the transistor radio played in the propagation of rock and roll, because it meant that young people didn't have to listen to their parents' music. They could do exactly that.
That's right. You know, listen to Radio North Sea, and various others I shan't mention.
You must have had a transistor radio at some point, Sebastian. Even if you don't remember, if you don't personally remember the valve-operated desktop or
maybe I'm a little bit too young for that. Even if I don't look it. To be honest, I don't think that ever came up on my radar. On my radar were portable tape recorders. And then, obviously, very quickly, the CD, portable CDs.
The next wave.
Whatever they were called.
But I remember, as a kid at school, when transistors became easily available, you know, the joy, you could actually shove a transistor into your pocket and you could buy an earphone. Earphone to be invented, too. And, they weren't around before. You know, they're a relatively modern invention. And you could listen to pop music on the bus on the way to school and then quickly conceal your transistor radio in your satchel or whatever.
Great. Anyway, yeah.
Actually, John, to ask you the same question I sort of put to Sebastian, are they actually available in North Korea? A portable transistor radio.
Yes, they are, but they are all fixed so that you can only listen to North Korean radio.
There's no way around that?
People? Yes, there is. Give me 5 minutes, I'll show you how to fix a radio back so you can listen to whatever you like. If you are caught with an adapted radio, with one that can listen to a capitalist radio station, you are in deep trouble. Mm. So people tend to be rather careful about it.
Final thought on this. Sebastian, I saw a quote earlier from Steve Wozniak, he of Apple, who says he judges all gadgets by the transistor radio because it brought music and life. It was a thing that that was personal, that he could carry around with him. Do you think at that level the transistor's been important, that it's the kind of the precursor of the idea that we can be entertained by a thing we can carry in our pocket?
Well, if Steve Wozniak says it, who am I to deny it?
We will have to leave it there. Sebastian Borger and John Everard, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll catch up with our correspondent in Colombia. We'll hear about a new festival of contemporary Middle Eastern and North African arts and culture. And we'll look at the latest film reviews, or film releases rather. But before all that, Bill Bingham has the world news headlines.
And the main story is Nigerian officials say they've reached a ceasefire deal with Boko Haram militants that includes the release of more than 200 kidnapped schoolgirls. The agreement includes an end to hostilities along with the release of 219 girls held captive since April. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has urged countries around the world to do more to help in the fight against Ebola. He's described a lack of donations to an emergency aid fund as a very serious problem, adding it was time more countries increased their assistance. New clashes have broken out between Hong Kong police and pro-democracy protesters. Officers have been using pepper spray and batons against the crowd. The scuffles erupted as demonstrators tried to reclaim a protest site in Mong Kok, cleared by police early on Friday. Search teams in Nepal have used shovels and ice axes to dig through thick snow and rescue about 40 hikers trapped for days on a Himalayan pass. Blizzards and avalanches killed at least 29 people 2 days ago in one of the world's worst mountain disasters. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill. Welcome back to Midori House. You're live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:31 in Moscow, 18:31 in London, 14:31 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world today. It's the turn of Anastasia Maloney in Bogota. Anastasia, welcome as ever to the show. First of all, Bogota still doesn't have a subway. They've been trying to get this together now for longer than most people in Colombia have been alive, literally. What is the problem?
Yes, this has been an ongoing issue, as you say, for almost more than 7 decades. And the capital really does need a metro because the traffic is absolutely gridlocked. It's very difficult to get around the city, and there's only a public bus system, and that is packed to the best of times. So the problem is really who's going to fund this massive project? And the mayor says that he's got the funding. But some officials in the government are disagreeing with him and saying that, in fact, he hasn't got the funds to get this project off the ground and that he needs more private companies getting on board. So the problem has always been issues over corruption, who's in charge of the projects, and really if there's enough money to build Bogota's first ever subway system.
Is there substantial public support for the idea, or is it one of those things that after however long it's been, people have just more or less given up imagining it's ever going to happen?
I think people, Bogotanos, have actually given up the idea that it's going to happen, but that doesn't mean that they don't want it to happen. There's a real need for some sort of transport system that can actually cater for the huge demand of the millions of people traveling across the city, because getting out in a car is just impossible. People are now walking and taking bikes instead. You just literally can't move around the city at some times. So there's definitely a need for it. Bogotanos definitely want it, but because it's been going for such a long time, it's very hard for people to imagine that this is actually going to happen, and on time and on budget.
Okay, well, looking slightly beyond Colombia's borders, Colombia is at loggerheads with Panama, which they do seem at many respects an unlikely pair of adversaries, but could you tell us what's behind that?
Yes, Panama and Colombia do really enjoy good relations, and they are close, obviously being border countries and a long history together. This latest incident has really caused tensions between the two countries. Colombia asked Panama to reveal financial information about Colombian investments in the country, and the Colombian government says that it's been waiting for a year for this financial data. to be revealed by Panama, and Panama has refused. And in response, Colombia put Panama on a blacklist of tax havens. Panama didn't respond kindly to that, and there are negotiations to try and see whether they can patch up quite situations at the moment. Colombian investors are quite worried about this because a lot of money is in Panama, and the Colombians says they just want to go after tax invaders, Colombian nationals who are hiding their assets and their investments in Panama because of the tax breaks and the lax tax laws that the Colombian government says. So the Colombian government says, really, we want to go after our tax invaders, but Panama says, you can't call us that. So there's this problem that they're trying to solve this week.
Is this a major thing in Colombia? I mean, is it a major issue, that a thing that people get upset about, the idea of rich people stashing all their money in Panama or elsewhere?
I think this has been going for quite a while, and I think that's not just Colombian investors that are stashing money away in Panama. I think it's an open secret that a lot of people choose Panama, as I said, because of its lack of transparency and lax tax laws. I don't think Colombia is the only country that would call Panama a tax haven. But I think what upsets Panama is precisely because Colombia and Panama do have close relations. They haven't had problems in the past. There's a lot of bilateral cooperation and trade between the two countries. And I think Panama was quite surprised by Colombia's response.
Okay, well, another, I mean, it's a thing concerning pretty much every country in the world at the moment, which is the Ebola outbreak currently occurring in West Africa. There's been various suggestions in various countries that countries should suspend flights from West Africa. Colombia, as I understand, has actually done this.
Yes, it hasn't actually suspended flights from those countries, but it has denied entry to several travellers from West Africa early this week at the airports. So Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea and Nigeria, there were travellers coming from those countries and they were denied entry into Colombia. In fact, Colombia is the first country in Latin America to deny entry to people coming from those countries. It's not really an official policy yet to close its borders to those countries, but it certainly seems to be going on. Also, that rule applies to Colombian nationals. And in fact, I renewed one of my ID cards a couple of weeks ago in the immigration office, and I was asked whether I had been to West Africa recently. So they're very much on the ball, particularly at their borders and at the main airports, and they are stopping people coming in from those countries.
But you say on the ball, doesn't this look more like somewhat cynical, faintly racist opportunism, given that there has been, to the best of my knowledge, zero recorded cases in Colombia?
That's right. This is exactly the conversation and debate that US Congress and the Senate had yesterday about whether it should close its borders. It is a debate that every country seems to be having at the moment, whether or not that is a good idea to stem the spread of Ebola. There have been a few scare cases of Ebola in Colombia, but it turned out they didn't have Ebola in the end. I just think Colombia has reacted, as many countries actually would want to react, to closing their borders.
What's the media coverage of the Ebola crisis been like in Colombia? Has it been the sort of the lurid panic stations that we've seen everywhere else?
Yes, there have been panic stations, and also there have been serious questions raised whether Colombia would be ready and prepared to deal with Ebola. And opposition politicians are saying that the health service and the hospitals and the clinics aren't ready to deal with that. So they've had exactly the same internal debates about whether the country's ready, whether it's got the protective gear, whether the health workers have been trained to deal with this outbreak, as most countries are across the world.
And what kind of message is the Colombian government sending to its people?
It's saying that if you do have symptoms of Ebola, such as high temperatures, or if you have had contact with people who have been in West Africa, then you should go to a hospital or health clinic. That's the message that they've been sending. But it's not a major issue at the moment, apart from a couple of people who have been under observation for Ebola, but then were found not to. But it's been a headline news, but it's still not at critical levels here in Colombia.
Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be hearing about the Noor Festival opening in London shortly.
Spirit, love, energy, and culture to be quickly accessible. Unreroute the river, let the dammed water be this, and people down the way this thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take five times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1840 here in London. Now, a six-week festival celebrating contemporary Middle Eastern and North African art and culture is about to start up here in London, this weekend, in fact. It's the Nuer Festival, and to tell us more about it, Yasmin Khan from the festival joins me here in the studio. Yasmin, welcome to the show. This is quite a production. There is about, if I'm doing my maths right, there's about 6 weeks of this, from the 20th of October to the 30th of November, and it seems to cover pretty much every form of expression as yet invented by man.
Exactly. The Nuer Festival is an annual celebration of contemporary art, film, literature and music from the Middle East and North Africa, which takes place across the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. And this year, the Nuer Festival will deliver a rich programme of events and activities through a spectrum of cultural expression from film, food, drama and dance, right through to painting and poetry. And as you say, it all kicks off next week, so lots to look forward to.
And what was the reason for bringing it together? Was there any particular impetus?
Well, if you look at the borough, I mean, the second most commonly spoken language is Arabic. It has a very high demographic of people from the Arab region and also from Iran, actually. So in terms of a constituency, it's very important. But also it has lots of cultural institutions and organisations that can actually have a hand in building engagement and participation with those communities. So going back to your question about the impetus for why it started as an educational programme in Leighton House Museum, which is a hidden gem sandwiched between Holland Park and High Street, Kingston. In case your listeners haven't ever been, I would highly recommend it. It has a beautiful Arab hall with beautiful Islamic mosaic tiles. And as I said, it started as an educational programme and blossomed into this rich, vibrant, diverse festival, which is in its fifth year.
Is there a measure of, when putting together a festival like this, do you feel like it's a reaction to or an attempt to balance, I guess, what is usually seen of the Middle East in the media? From, you know, it's a region from which the news is really good and from which people who don't actually visit it could well assume a kind of negative impression.
So there's nothing tokenistic about this festival at all, because it's co-curated with the community. So a call goes out earlier in the year and submissions are proposed, and then based on their quality and their ability to be thought-provoking and challenge stereotypes, they're selected and in partnership with the organisation. So it's not at all, you know, pandering to any kind of stereotype or pastiche image of what the Middle East is.
So what kind of things are there any particular highlights this year that you're especially looking forward to, for example?
Well, I'm probably best to tell you about the one that I'm curating called Sinbad Sci-Fi. On the 15th of November at the Science Museum IMAX Theatre, we're going to be talking about Arab science fiction from imagination to innovation. And this is very much looking at Arab science fiction as a prism to explore themes to do with science and fiction, but also what is the link between imagination and innovation? And is science fiction the ultimate bridge for those things? things and how we explore notions of the other, what it means to be an alien. And if you look at lots of literature, say War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells, it was almost a kind of forbearing of, oh, the aliens are coming for us, the other is approaching. So I think a lot of those themes are very resonant, and there's lots more to kind of pick out there. And this is a sequel event to last year's highly successful Salon at the Dana Centre. And so please book early.
Is there a distinguishing, I guess, characteristic about Arab science fiction that makes it specifically Arab as opposed to everybody else's science fiction? Or does Arab science fiction tend to preoccupy itself with flying saucers and little green men?
I think
that's
a great question, and this is something we'll be looking at. I mean, it can be anything you want it to be. It's a very diverse genre. It can have a local resonance as much as something that can be as relevant to the Western sphere, if you like. But I think essentially it's that meat space. So my impetus for this event is about engaging in the dialogue. It's about bringing people together who might think they have nothing in common, but actually can find ways to connect with each other. So there'll be people from the sci-fi fandom, there'll be Arabists, there'll be all sorts of people from all walks of life coming together and talking about something they're very passionate about.
And are there aspects of the exhibition, and I know it's a big exhibition, but are there aspects that deal with the events of the last 3 or 4 years, which have been eventful even by the quite formidable standards of the region?
Yeah, absolutely. So possibly one to highlight is the readings from Syria Speaks, which is happening at Chelsea Theatre. And if you look at what's happening in the region, obviously it's been very dismal in the news and nothing positive. And I think this is
it's not just nothing positive. It's just that we simply have no real idea what's actually happening in Syria especially.
I think that's really true. And in a way, people have become desensitised and those stories are very remote from us and kind of irrelevant to our daily lives. But I think what events like this do is to kind of go back to the people, to the stories they bring, to their experiences, and actually enable us to connect in new ways. So this event will be, exploring those experiences through readings, through poetry, through theatre and through food. In quite an unusual way. So, and this is in support by the British Council. So really unusual way of tackling very difficult themes, but in a much more positive way that's constructive.
Okay, there's a musical component to the festival as well, of course.
Lots of music. So thanks to the Royal Albert Hall, we have two highlights. So one is Meshru Leila, happening on the 15th of November. And that's quite radical in a way because it's the only Arab band with an openly gay frontman as its lead singer. And the other one is Saoud Massi, who's one of the leading Algerian world music artists, who has a very unique style, and she blends rock, folk, country, classical and flamenco.
That's, I'm trying in my head to imagine how that's going to...
Come and hear it.
That could really go one of several ways. I'm extending the benefit of the doubt for the moment. One other event I did definitely want to ask about, because you did mention there is a food aspect to it, and it's always been one of my favourite reasons to visit the Middle East. But I know we did an item recently, it's either been broadcast or is about to be or is on our website, on our food and drink programme, The Menu, about Lebanese wine. There is something about this, which is interesting me at least.
This is called A Beautiful Accident of History, Lebanese Wine. That's the title anyway. It's on the 7th of November. And this is curated by Anissa, who's a food writer and journalist, broadcaster and blogger. And this is her quote. She says, "Food is culture and one of the gateways to understand a country and its people." So there you have it.
I cannot argue with that. Yasmin Khan, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yasmin Khan from the Noor Festival of the Arts, 20th of October to 30th of November. Details at the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea's website. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for some music on Midori House. This is Kyla LaGrange. Kyla LaGrange with Cut Your Teeth. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's coming up for the end of the show, which means it's time for our daily arts review. Today, once again, we're talking about film, and once again, we're talking about it with Tim Robey, film critic for The Telegraph here in the UK. Tim, welcome back to the programme. World War II. Do we have enough films about World War II?
Yeah, we don't have enough films about five men in a tank. charging around Germany in 1944.
This is, of course, Fury, starring Brad Pitt. Now, we must have reached the point, seriously, in which it would require literally longer than World War II went on for to watch every film about World War II ever made.
You're probably right.
I reckon that's the case. So what does Fury, otherwise known as Five Men and a Tank, tell us that everything else hasn't?
I'm not sure it tells us anything that we haven't already been told, but it does tell it extremely loudly and brutally. It's an incredibly uncompromising, kind of like having your face smacked into a wall for 2.5 hours sort of war film.
And is that in a good way?
I'm not convinced it's wholly in a good way. I think there's some really great sequences in the middle where you can see that they've managed to pull off that kind of Sam Fuller, Sam Peckinpah style war movie, which is going to tell it as they imagine it really was. You know, there are no kind of reflective pauses, sentimental music. It's just incredibly hard-hitting and grim, and you're sort of being sloshed around in mud for most of the time. I think the film slightly loses its footing for me towards the end. The choreography of all that carnage just becomes relentless. And I think when you're in a tank, it's very clear when you've just got one other tank up against you where you're going to be pointing. And those sequences where they're basically, it's tank versus tank, are very effective. But when the entire German army is sort of swarming all over you, it loses its sense of place, I think.
How much do they make of the tank motif? Because I haven't seen the film. We will hear a clip from it shortly. I haven't seen it, but the synopsis did put me in mind of, what was the film called? Help me out here, Lebanon.
About Lebanon, yeah.
In which I thought the tank, in which you saw everything from the tank, but I thought that was a very good depiction of how a soldier at war feels, which is they can only see and control what's around them, and really they have no idea what's happening a block away. They have very little sense of the grand story in which they're participating.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that film was it set itself that limitation in a very effective way, and this is much less claustrophobic. There's a whole section in the middle where they go to a kind of bombed out town, and they hang out, and they have some food with some of the local women, and then it becomes tense. It becomes kind of like a Tarantino-ish sequence where the slightly less sort of morally upright members of this particular five-man crew enter that equation, and suddenly it becomes rather gross and tense.
Okay, well, we have a clip from Fury. Listeners are advised to stand back.
If you think it can't get worse, it can, and it will. The dying's not done. The killing's not done.
I promised my crew a long time ago I'd keep them alive.
Sergeant Collier, I'm your new assistant driver.
Tank school? That's home.
That was one of the quieter interludes, presumably, of Fury.
It was, yeah. This is from the guy who wrote Training Day, and he's directed mainly movies about kind of very violent LA cops. And it's like he's transferred that brutality onto the German battlefield. I think Brad Pitt would be more effectively cast as a Nazi at this point in his career than he is as an American tank colonel.
He was an anti-Nazi.
He was anti-Nazi, yeah. And I actually think he would be rather a good Nazi. And another thing where the film falls down a little bit is in the kind of performance camp. The best person in it is the young greenhorn guy who's only just arrived and doesn't even know, you know, what he has to do, Logan Lerman. I think he's actually quite good. The others, I don't feel as though we get to know them very deeply, so it's hard to care too much when everyone starts getting blown to bits. That's a big problem.
Okay, well, we'll introduce our discussion of the second film we're talking about with a clip from it. Listeners, using their skill and judgment, are invited to try and guess the title.
If it's in a word or it's in a look, you can't get rid of the Babadook. A rumbling sound, then three sharp knocks. That's when you'll know he's around. You'll see him if you look.
Babadook, dook, dook.
Yes, that is, of course, from Herbie Goes Bananas. No, it's not. It's a new film called The Babadook. It's an Australian horror film. My people are very keen on making those. We do seem to have a thing for sort of wanting to wish ill on ourselves and our sort of, you know, peculiar remote utopia into which we are born. Where does this rate in the pantheon?
It's pretty high. I think this is a really effective film. I mean, it's a very simple idea. It's kind of this pop-up book monster that kind of comes to life and starts threatening a single mother and her son. But it's one of those horror films where you start off with that premise and then you realise that it could be read as a kind of metaphor for the breakdown of this family, basically. That the Babadook is the kind of grief generated by the death of the dad in the family come real and come to attack them. It's extremely scary, I think. The sequences where the kind of creature itself keeps turning up, the book keeps arriving on the doorstep, and then it kind of comes out of the book and is crawling all over the ceiling and pulling back sheets and things like that. Very effective stuff. It's actually been expanded from a short film, I think, with the same name or with the same idea by the director Jennifer Kent, and I recommend it very highly.
Okay, well, finally tonight we need to talk about Citizen 4. This is a documentary by Laura Poitras about Edward Snowden, although she's not really an impartial observer of Snowden. She is kind of a compadre, if you will. So I'm guessing it's not a terrifically sceptical approach to Snowden.
It's not hugely sceptical, but it puts you right there. That's the kind of value of it. It really puts you in the hotel room in Hong Kong for the kind of 8 days while they were thrashing out how to kind of put all those revelations out there. Laura Poitras was one of his first ports of call when he was kind of looking for people to share this information with. She set up the meeting with him and took a camera, and we're basically in there, and they're kind of figuring out how is this going to play? At what point is his identity going to become the story, as opposed to what it means about the US government? You know, those two aspects of the story are both there. And I think he does come off awfully well in it. And he's a remarkably zen in it, given the hell that's about to break loose.
Is it a film that's likely, and this is going to be, unfortunately, I'm going to need a really brief answer to this. Is it a film that's likely to change anyone's mind about him, or will people tend to...
It changed my mind about him.
Really?
Yeah. I think I didn't know enough about him in a way. And I think just allowing him to speak for himself at such length, you really get a sense of the guy and what his motives were.
So changed your mind more into Camp Snowden than you previously
were?
Well,
I would say I was kind of a bit of a fence sitter probably before, and I am now more of a Snowdenite. I'm on Team Edward.
Okay, well, that's Citizen 4. Tim Robey from The Telegraph, thank you as ever for joining us. That's all for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, John Everard and Sebastian Borger. The show today was produced by Alice Block, researched by David Pleasant and Amanda Valmorbida. Our studio manager was Joel Church. The menu is up after the headlines, which I think contains that item about Lebanese wine. And then at 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson for The Daily. This show returns at 1800 on Monday. For this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and have a good weekend.
London. Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.